This is Derek's O'Reilly Auto Parts story.
After the third time jump-starting my car, I finally realized my battery was dying. So I stopped by O'Reilly to have it checked. They tested it right there in the parking lot. It was bad, real bad. But they helped me find the right battery for my car and even installed it for free. Now my car starts like new.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
FNC Mont Bellevue, Houston.
Hi, I'm Mark Hughes, Stoke City manager, and you're listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN.
Well, that's when Mark Hughes was the Stoke City manager, and what a name he was when Stoke City came here to Houston to play the Dynamo, then with Jeff Cameron. At the half, Toronto FC, a 3-2 lead over Montreal. Later tonight, Chivas and Club America also in action in the Copa por Mexico. So a big night of soccer on TV, and we've had more television and televised soccer matches than we could ask for. Lustav Vermouth, perfect enhancer for a gin and tonic, a margarita. It's fun with tapas. It is a taste of Spain. Lustav Vermouth has wonderful botanicals. It pairs well with lemon and limes. I like it in a variety of ways, sometimes over ice with tonic water or club soda. Probably my favorite, though, in a gin and tonic because it's so hot right now. It is refreshing. Go to your local liquor store, ask for Lustav Vermouth, and add a little something to your repertoire from Spain. And enhance your margarita, enhance your gin and tonics, or just pour it over ice. Add a little orange peel, couple drops of lime juice as well. It's fantastic, perfect for this time of the year. So each and every show now we have La Liga update presented by Lustav. Okay, time now for part two with James Shield from the Sheffield Star.
James Wilder with us, Sheffield United correspondent, the Star. Okay, look, you took me back into, yes, a lot of these, some of these older school test of time things that can be transferred to the modern game are definitely in play at Sheffield United. But to get into the Premier League and do what he's doing now, there's had to have been some subtle changes, either tactically, with a little bit of personnel. What are some of the subtle changes that have occurred now that they've gotten into the Premier League under Chris Wilder?
I think possibly the best way of illustrating what these subtle changes are, if I can focus on the system and the strategy that Sheffield United employ, because it is very, very unusual, and it's been sort of a subject of fascination for some very famous managers, actually, since they came up. Jurgen Klopp, Pep Guardiola, Marcelo Bielsa at Leeds, who look like they're going to get promoted this year, but obviously is a huge name in world football, have all sort of expressed how interested and fascinated they are by the way Sheffield United play. And what that is it's a three at the back system. But unusually, they have two very attacking wing backs, but very unusually, the two outside centre halves are also encouraged to attack and go forward on the overlap as well. So very often you will get a wing back and a centre half exchanging passes with each other on the edge of the opposition box. It sounds as if it should be a recipe for chaos. And believe you and me, if it hadn't been as well drilled and the moves hadn't been as well choreographed as they have been on the training ground, it would be chaos. But it's not. The results show you that. It was a system that they very, very rarely deviated from for the first 3 years of Chris Wilder's reign. But you've seen this year it's become a little bit more flexible, and it's had to be, because to begin with, at the start of the sort of this squad's journey, they were very much a team that liked to overwhelm sides, as you would expect with a system like that. They were very much a team that liked to suffocate the opposition in terms of possession. And I think there was a recognition that we're going into the Premier League against some of these great clubs and these great players. We're not going to be dominating possession like that. We can't do it. And they were told that if you play this system in the Premier League, there was the famous phrase, I won't embarrass the guy who said it by naming him, but you know, he said very publicly in the media over here, he was a former player, former, you know, top flight international.
I think we all know.
Sheffield United will be down by Christmas if they play this way. And they have played this way. Essentially, the system is the same. But they've had the last laugh because there have been a couple of subtle tweaks. You've seen the ability of that squad to, you know, switch from a three at the back to a five at the back when the situation demands. You've seen them sort of grow tactically. You've seen them become sort of more mature in the way that they'll actually plot a course through games and the way that players will make decisions for themselves. And I think that comes from confidence, but I also think it strikes at the heart of something else that's really integral to the story of this Sheffield United team. And that is signing players who have all of the overwhelming majority of this squad have all had knockbacks in their careers. That's a common thread running right the way through the group. An awful lot of them, in fact, most of them, have come through from the lower leagues. They've not sort of, you know, had a decorated career at top flight level or very often come through a top flight academy. They've all had to work their way up. But they've all clearly got potential and they've all clearly got a huge degree of ability because they wouldn't be achieving these results in the Premier League if this was on effort alone. I could go out there and put an awful lot of effort in, but I can tell you I wouldn't be delivering the results that these Sheffield United players are. But they've managed to sign intelligent footballers whose potential for one reason or another hasn't been unlocked somewhere else. And they've looked at the culture of the football club. They've looked at the demands of that system and thought, you know what, Glenn or James, they might not have been doing great things at this football club that they're at now. But I tell you what, I look at the qualities of, you know, that they've got. I look at the strengths that they've got, and more importantly, I look at their personality, and you know what? I think those two guys actually want to learn, they want to work, and they've got that sort of, you know, thirst for knowledge. We'll bring them here. We think they'll thrive here, and by and large, that's exactly what's happened. So they've just become a much more sort of mature side. But so there have been subtle changes, but I think the key thing is there's not been sort of changes to that core ethos of what Sheffield United do, either in terms of the way they recruit or the way they play.
So what I'm hearing here is very coachable players, guys that were looked upon, that they can retain information, they can carry it out tactically, but also a healthy chip on the shoulder.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there is, you know, we speak to them regularly, and there is this sort of almost perverse enjoyment amongst the squad that I think they're enjoying the fact that, you know, they were written off so strongly at the start of the season. They were told they weren't good enough. They were told they weren't good enough in the Championship as well, in the division below, by the way. And, you know, they have really enjoyed that sort of, you know, just ability to, I don't know, I was going to say something rude then, but you know what I mean to the critics. They do enjoy that. They do enjoy that. But I think as well, at the core of all of it, of all of that, I think when you mention that chip on the shoulder, I also think there's a really healthy chip on the shoulder in the sense that a lot of these guys think, you know what, we possibly deserved an opportunity before we even came to Sheffield United. And it's something as well that I think is so, so important. And again, just let me go back to that game against Chelsea. A lot of the narrative around the football club, as I think we've said, is the fact that they're very big on effort, they're very big on team spirit, and they're a team rather than a collection of sort of, you know, very, very, you know, talented individuals. All of those things are true. But the one thing that narrative, which is so strong about Sheffield United over here in England, does, it overlooks the fact that there are some hugely, hugely skilled footballers within that squad as well. And I think it, you know, it possibly looking beyond the confines of Bramall Lane, I think there'll be a few scouts elsewhere in football thinking, you know what, I think we might have to sort of take a look at some of the methods we use to identify players here. Because
so you think by what they're doing, you mentioned all the coaches that are observing them now, that there are people learning from what's going on with this club. There has to be people. If they're not looking at this, I would think they're not doing their jobs because of the resources and the magical things that are happening here on the field. And they're not flashing the pan.
No. And I think you're absolutely right. People should be learning. I mean, for example, I'll just very quickly give you one player. John Fleck, who, you know, was in his mid-20s, had come through at Glasgow Rangers, had left that football club when they financially imploded. Everybody's heard of Glasgow Rangers, you know, wonderful football club. But then found himself at Blackpool and at Coventry City in the third tier of English football in his mid-20s. Now, I mean this with no disrespect to Coventry City, because Sheffield United were in that division when they signed him at the time. But to be able to sign a player like that on a free contract and for him to still be playing third-tier football in his mid-20s, I think something's gone wrong with scouting in football. If a player like that, who is now, you know, one of the most effective players at that football club, is one of the most effective players in the Premier League in terms of midfielders, was in the third tier of English football only 4 years ago, I think something's gone wrong. And do you know what? Forgive me, Glenn. I said I'll just give you one example.
Okay.
An even better one, possibly, is David McGoldrick, who scored 2 goals against Chelsea. But when he arrived at Sheffield United in 2018, this is a guy who didn't have a football club. He'd just been released by Ipswich Town. And I know, having spoken to David, you know, he said, my phone wasn't ringing. He said, nobody was getting in touch with me. He said, the only offer I had on the table was, again, from a third division football club in England. And I was going to have to take it. Then all of a sudden, he said, fortunately, the phone rang. It's Chris Wilder at Sheffield United on the phone. Would you like to come in and train with us? I've had a word with a couple of your previous managers. I think you'd do a great job for us. You know, now, 2 years on, this is a guy who's got his international place back with the Republic of Ireland. And I'm not getting carried away when I say this, but I think it's one of the most intelligent footballers.
Remarkable. James, listen, thank you so much for coming on. You've really helped take us deeper into the Sheffield United story. And I hope we can do this again here as the Blades keep on powering forward. And then one day we'll talk about the time Sheffield United came right here to Houston, Texas. How about that?
So that was James Shield of the Sheffield Star. Really, really interesting stuff there. When we come back, we're going to bring on Tyrone Marshall from the Manchester Evening News. We're going to talk Manchester United again. This is prior to today's United result, 2-0 today over Crystal Palace. Tyrone Marshall will join us. We'll talk both United and City. So we've got a Manchester segment coming up later on in the show. We will also have Houston Dynamo midfielder, 2-goal scorer against LAFC, Memo Rodriguez, join us. We'll take a break. Break is brought to you by John Daspit, the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com.
You're listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 97.5.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to the show. Billy Squire, Lonely as a Night. Hope everybody's doing well out there. These are definitely trying times. Stay positive. It's all we can do, day by day. Stay positive. Right now, Toronto FC with a 3-2 lead over Montreal. Montreal did get a goal from Ramel Kyoto, the former Dynamo. Also, RGV was going to play San Antonio FC. That game has been postponed, Rio Grande Valley, due to somebody testing positive for COVID. So that game is off as well. Chivas, a little later tonight, will take on Club America in that match. All right, right now we go to Tyrone Marshall of the Manchester Evening News.
Well, Tyrone, let's just first get a lot of Manchester United fans across the Atlantic here in the States heartbroken with the way that game ended with the stoppage time equalizer, the dropping of 2 points against Southampton. What's the reaction been over in Manchester?
The same, really. Just a real sort of real sickener for them, the form they've been in and the way they were playing and the fact they led that game. And so, you know, so close towards the end of the season, only three games left now. And, you know, with seconds to play, they were third. And then now they end up fifth. And obviously, you had the City decision earlier in the day. So we know top four will only get Champions League now. So it's, although it's still in their hands because they've got to go to Leicester on the final day, it kind of takes away any kind of wriggle room. It takes away any kind of safety net. They've got no margin for error now. They probably have to win all of those three remaining games to get top four. So it was a real, you know, a real bitter pill to swallow, I think, for a lot of United fans. I think they thought the job was done at 2-1, so that didn't come into the game, but they were holding firm. It just showed in the end that I think, you know, they needed another goal, and perhaps they didn't push hard enough for it in the second half.
Tyrone Marshall, senior football writer, Manchester Evening News. How is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer positioned this? Because he's got to quickly position this in the context of the rest of the schedule and kind of look forward, I think, in a finite way.
Yeah, he has. You know, he's very disappointed at the concession of a late equaliser, disappointed not to keep that winning run going. But he knows that this is still in United's hands. He knows that three wins will still secure a top four finish, possibly even third, with Chelsea and Leicester struggling ahead of them. So, you know, there is that positivity. In January, when United were really struggling, and even further back than that, if you'd have offered them the three games to go, that top four was in their hands, they would have taken it. Obviously, it's hugely disappointing that any margin for error has gone now. And there is immense pressure on those three games and immense pressure on Thursday night against Crystal Palace, especially with an FA Cup semi-final coming up on the Sunday. So it's going to be difficult to juggle his resources. And he ended on change team for the fifth time last night. But I think it's clear that rotation is needed. They look tired towards the end. So he's definitely got a big job on this week to try and lift the players and get two difficult squad selections right.
Tyrone Marshall, senior football writer, Manchester Evening News. Yeah, so take me into that because, you know, you get people over here talking, well, we're looking at the schedule and these teams are near the bottom of the table. This is an easy 3 points. But you're talking about depth rotation now with a very heavy schedule here. Do they have the depth to get it done?
It's very difficult to say, really. I mean, I think the fact he named an unchanged team last night is perhaps an admission that they don't have the depth they would want. And he made 8 changes for the FA Cup quarterfinal at Norwich, and they won that game late in extra time, but they were really poor, and they won the game once he'd made 6 substitutes and the senior players had come back on. And the 8 players who came in that day did themselves no favours in terms of pushing for inclusion. And I think that game made it clear that they don't have the depth, and that when you take some of these key players out, there is a significant drop-off in quality. And at the moment, it's just too difficult a risk to take. And I think the idea of playing that strongest team last night was that they get the victory, they get third place, and it does kind of give them the chance to make a few changes at Crystal Palace, to maybe take a draw, hope that the fringe players come in and do the business. Whereas now, they put themselves under pressure in that they probably do have to make changes because they're going to want to play their strongest team against Chelsea. But at the same time, those players coming in really have to step up to the plate on Thursday night. And I think the reality is that the first 11's looking good, but the fringe players just aren't good enough. There's just not required depth there.
The fringe players, those guys that now need to produce in these moments now to really help push this team over the finish line and get that Champions League money. Who are a couple that are key to you that you really think have to produce and there's a bit of pressure on?
I think there's probably going to be midfielders coming in midweek on Thursday night. I think Fred will probably play. I think Nemanja Matic needs a rest. You're probably looking at maybe breaking up that Pogba and Fernandes partnership as well on Thursday night. Pogba came off early last night and it wasn't his best game. So I think maybe you're looking at bringing another midfielder in there. And in terms of that front three, I think it's Mason Greenwood's quietest game for a while on Monday night. So Daniel James is probably going to come in. Maybe even you bring in Ighalo for one of Rashford or Martial, perhaps for Martial. So I think those are probably the key men. And certainly, you know, it's the front three and the front five, really, if you include Pogba and Fernandes, that have been behind United's recent good run. So if you do take any of those out and bring someone in, you know, if you bring a Fred in or a Daniel James or a Ighalo, I think the pressure's really on them to perform.
Talking to Tyrone Marshall, the senior football writer of the Manchester Evening News. We're getting it straight from Manchester, and we really appreciate it, as always, Tyrone. All right, again, and I asked you this the last time we had you on the show, Just give me your thoughts on Paul Pogba. Do you feel the buy-in is a little bit bigger now for him as a United player?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's come back and although he didn't play brilliantly against Southampton, he's really impressed in the starts he has had recently. And, you know, he's looking like the kind of player United thought they'd bought previously. I think it helps that he's fitting in a team that is playing well now and looks to have a good structure. I don't think it suits him being the star man and being the player who has the pressure to lift all his teammates with him. I think this scenario where you've got Bruno Fernandes playing so well and the front three playing so well suits him better. I think the reality for Paul Pogba as well is that there's no club that can afford him this summer. Every top club in Europe, the likes of Real Madrid, Juventus, his likely destinations are all counting the cost of coronavirus and the loss of revenue. And the reality is that United are going to want £100 million plus for him. And I don't think, realistically, no club can afford to pay that at the moment. So I just don't think there's a market there for him. So I think he accepts that he's going to be staying at United next season. He's looked a lot happier. And in what he said over the last couple of weeks, he sounded a lot happier with the way things are going. And I think if they can get that top four finish, I think he'll be happy to stay next season and maybe try and push them on even further.
All right. So when you look at the turnaround here, which is pretty remarkable. And again, I know I said this to you. I was over at the Aston Villa match at the end of November, early December. And boy, it was pretty gloomy. It was gloomy in the press. It was gloomy with different criticisms. It wasn't the best of game, the 1-1 draw. Outside of the Bruno signing, what did that put in motion here to kind of change things and put this team in the direction that they've gone in since this, COVID-19 break?
The signing of Fernandes has been absolutely crucial. I mean, that is undoubtedly top of the list. He has raised the performance levels of his teammates.
So can I ask you about him? Can I stay on him for
a second? Yeah, yeah.
Was it? Did you see what I saw? I saw this guy step into the team, no hesitation. Not necessarily, and I mean in a healthy way, respecting everyone else who's there from a leadership perspective. I saw this guy go in there and grab it, and I thought he lifted other people. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely, yeah. I think United knew what they were getting in terms of a quality footballer, even though I think they were probably surprised to have a free run at him, really, for £47 million. But I think they knew they were getting a good footballer who could influence games in the final third. But I think they've been surprised at the quality of his leadership and the demands he places on teammates. From the moment he stepped onto the pitch, he was not afraid to tell his teammates where they were going wrong. He's not afraid to dish out some old-fashioned advice if there's a misplaced pass. And it's clear he is a born winner. He demands high standards. He demands high standards from himself. When he produces them, he demands high standards from his teammates. And I think that's had a huge impact on the squad, that they have got someone there who is not afraid to tell it as it is. And if the performances aren't good enough and the standards aren't good enough, he will tell it as it is. And there's been a couple of moments. They had a draw at Everton before the season was suspended. And there was kind of the idea that this was a decent point for United, that Everton were playing well at the time. And Fernandes did the post-match interviews at the time and he just said, no, that's, it's not the case. It's not a good point. It was the same at Tottenham. He did the interviews on the first game back. This is not a good point. We're Manchester United. We should be winning every game and wanting to win every game, really. So, he has changed the entire environment around the squad. He's lifted everyone with him and carried everyone with him. And I think his impact has been absolutely enormous.
Tyrone Marshall, senior football writer, Manchester Evening News. All right, so add on to that some of the other things that you thought that put into motion that's helped lift United now.
I think the biggest thing is what Fernandes has given to the front three in terms of he's given them service. Rashford and Martial were both having good seasons beforehand, but they were kind of having to do it on their own. There was a lack of goals from midfield, a lack of creativity from midfield. And there were times where, when United could play on the counter-attack, they looked good. When they had to break down deep defences, they just looked completely clueless in the first half of the season. And I think with Fernandes, that's completely changed. He's given creativity. He's given defences another problem to solve. And the transformation in their attacking play has been absolutely incredible. The games that they've won so comfortably recently are the games they were struggling earlier in the season, yet they look so dangerous going forward. They can produce goals out of nothing. And I think it is the transformation of that attacking play that is the real reason behind their turnaround in form.
Tyrone Marshall, senior football writer, Manchester Evening News. All right, some of that leadership and that, hey, we're united, a point's not acceptable, that kind of an attitude. Were you disappointed that a little more of that didn't come from Harry Maguire early on?
Possibly. I think the club have been pleased with his leadership as well. I think they saw him as a future United captain when they signed him. And I think Solskjaer was so impressed by his on-pitch leadership that he was happy to give him that role in January. But I don't think he's had he didn't have the same impact as Fernandes. And it's perhaps a leader in a different mould, really, than Fernandes. He's not the type that Fernandes is going to turn around and dish out some some home truths to his teammates. I think Maguire's sort of a more all-encompassing leader and you know, an arm around the shoulder leader. And United have been pleased with him as captain. I don't think he's had the impact on the pitch, on that defence, that perhaps they hoped for. There was obvious comparisons with Virgil van Dijk with the fact that United paid so much money for him. And, you know, he's clearly not had the same sort of impact on United's defence that van Dijk had on Liverpool's. And United's defence is still very much a work in progress. But I think United will be happy enough with Maguire's first season. And I think, you know, he gives different leadership to Fernandes, but I think they're very happy with him as a captain.
All right, I want to take you, Tyrone, into another player. David De Gea. Is there something going on with him? He just seems, it's almost like he's unemotional. He doesn't seem like he's happy in goal. He doesn't seem the presence that he once was. Mm. Is there something going on there?
It's very difficult to know. I mean, it is a mystery. His drop in form has probably been going on for 18 months now. And, you know, he still produces world-class saves. And in that regard, he can still do it. But there's just too many mistakes coming into his game, whether it's a complacency thing. You know, it's difficult to really put your finger on it, but there are too many mistakes that weren't there when he was the best goalkeeper in the world. He obviously signed a new contract last year and is very, very well paid, to the point that United would find it almost impossible to find a buyer for him. So he is kind of stuck here now, but he signed that contract knowing full well this was a long-term rebuilding project, and things are going well, and by all accounts he is happy at the club. But there's certainly pressure on his position, there's pressure on his performances now, and you know, although he's not having shockers consistently, there just are too many mistakes creeping into his game, and I think that's a major concern for United.
All right, you've made a great point about him as being a shot stopper and more of a line goalkeeper to me. Yeah. Is that pretty much accepted there, that he's not a guy that's really coming off his line and has the depth to come way out to command a penalty area?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's a very different keeper to the likes of Alisson and Ederson and even Hugo Lloris, and he is kind of a dominate the 6-yard box, but he doesn't have a starting position on the edge of his own penalty area when teams are launching counter-attacks. He is more of a line goalkeeper, as you say. I mean, it shows how quickly goalkeeping moves on. In a way, he's probably considered a bit old-fashioned now, in that his strengths probably aren't with his feet either, when you look at what Ederson and Alisson can do. United are trying to play out from the back a little bit more, but De Gea's distribution is nowhere near the level of those two. So he probably is considered a little bit of an old-fashioned goalkeeper now, but you know, if United can get him back to their best, then I think they'd prefer the points he was saving them to what those others can offer.
He's Tyrone Marshall, senior football writer, Manchester Evening News. We're talking about Manchester United right now. All right, transfer market. I know we're looking a little ahead here, and it gets silly with all the rumors and all. Jadon Sancho's been linked amongst a whole bunch of other people to Manchester United. What are the biggest needs for them? Because one of them we've spoken about is depth, but maybe positionally for you.
I think it's changed over the last 6 months. I mean, Jadon Sancho has always been top target, and he would obviously add a lot to this squad because he's a phenomenal player. But the way Mason Greenwood performed on the right wing, it's perhaps not as an essential deal as it was kind of 6-7 months ago, although he is still United's top target. And I think there's perhaps a change in perception that maybe they need to look at that defence now, that I think this unbeaten run has probably been masking a few flaws in the defence and a few too many individual errors. The way they've been playing recently is kind of accelerated talk of when to expect a title challenge and when a title challenge could arrive. And I think while the attack is clearly good enough to mount and sustain a title challenge, I think there's definitely concern that the defence is perhaps not good enough, and still question marks over Lindelof as a suitable partner for Maguire. Maybe still question marks over Luke Shaw as well. So I think they will look to get the Sancho deal done, and I'm not sure how many other deals they will do given the financial implications of playing behind closed doors. But I think there's perhaps an acceptance now that defence will need looking at sooner rather than later.
Well, Tyrone, you know I wasn't going to let you escape without this final question here. It is important. And made it very clear you're right down the middle when it comes to United and City.
Yeah.
Right. The overturning of the ban for Manchester City and the financial fair play, did that surprise you?
Speaking to people at Manchester City, it didn't really, because they were immensely confident it would always get overturned. In fact, they were immensely confident they wouldn't get banned in the first place. So, you know, they've never had any doubts that they were going to win this appeal and that they wouldn't be banned from the Champions League. I think they were surprised that UEFA did hit them with a ban from the Champions League. We're still waiting for the full ruling to come out from the Court of Arbitration for Sport. But I think it's obvious that a lot of the issues relating to this, as we knew, date back more than 5 years, which in UEFA's statutes means they can't be punished. So I think there's maybe an element here of UEFA just felt it was too important a case to to let slip by, and then they had to, even though they knew eventually they might lose it, they had to try and make a case of an example of City. But it's been a distraction the club didn't need and they didn't want. And fundamentally, as they pointed out, they have been punished for these offences previously. They agreed a settlement with UEFA back in 2014 for financial fair play breaches. They are compliant with FFP now. Their revenue streams have rocketed in recent years. They're a well-run club in terms of the books now, and certainly comply with FFP. And although they've got a lot of £50 to £60 million players, they're by no means the worst example in Europe of clubs who inflate the transfer market and overspend. You know, their transfer record is probably way down on quite a few other clubs in Europe. They don't overpay on wages, and they do try and strike the right balance. So, you know, they in terms of the modern day City, they are compliant with FFP. This is a case that dredged up things they felt they'd been punished for previously, and I think they're just happy to see the back of it now and to know that they will be in the Champions League next year.
Pep and Manchester City, are they positioned well for the future?
I think so. It's a difficult one to say, really, because although this was a distraction hanging over them and they'll be glad it's gone, there are still other issues. Obviously, they've lost their title this year. They're a long way behind Liverpool. They've lost a lot of games in a similar manner this year. Virtually all of their league defeats have followed the same kind of pattern. And it's clear that they do need to spend big this summer, and they are planning on spending big. It's clear they need work on that defence. They're going to lose David Silva and Leroy Sané. They obviously lost Kompany without replacing him next year. So there's key players who were involved in their last two title wins that have gone and do need replacing. And also, it's going to be interesting to see that Guardiola's never been in this position before. He won three titles at Barcelona. Real Madrid won it in the fourth and Pep left. He won three titles at Bayern. First season at City, he was building a title-winning team, then they won the title. So he's never lost a title and had to rebuild a team before. So we're going to see something from Pep that we've not seen in his managerial career before. It's obvious that City squad needs a bit of rejuvenation. And Pep's contract expires at the end of next year. I think there's still probably an expectation that he will leave after 5 years, although neither he or the club have firmly closed the book on that, so you never know. But I think, you know, I think they'll be confident that they can certainly push Liverpool and try and get that title back next year. But it's clear they need to spend to do so. And if they can convince Guardiola to sign a new contract sooner rather than later, it would obviously give a lot of stability as well when it comes to trying to convince people to sign for them.
Tyrone, are you surprised with some of the clubs and their inability to find central defenders? I'm talking maybe Chelsea, Arsenal. It is sometimes stunning to me. Is that part and parcel, you think, of the modern game and we're looking for footballers first and not looking for defenders first? I mean, how do you make sense of that? Because when I look at Arsenal, I look at Chelsea, and just sometimes how feeble they look defensively, it almost shocks me with the resources that they have.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a dearth of probably a lack of world-class central defenders these days. And I think it's also partly a case of teams kind of build from the front these days. There used to be the old adage that title-winning teams were built on a defence, but these days, you know, City had a brilliant attack the year before they won the league and added a defence. Liverpool had an incredible attack and then signed Van Dijk and Alisson. So I think there's an argument. United are almost doing that now, that they've got a brilliant attack and now they need to look at the defence. And I think the fact that so many teams do play such attacking football inevitably is going to leave the defence exposed, whereas previously you probably had more support in midfield for the defence. And I think nowadays there's a lot more one-on-one defending. Defenders are a lot more exposed and there's a lot more attacking football, which is great for us watching. Probably makes defenders' jobs harder, which I think is why they probably get criticised more. And I do think there's, you know, compared to perhaps the 1990s, there's nowhere near the level of high-class, world-class defenders that there was in the game then.
Well, Tyrone, listen, as always, you're a real treat for my listeners. I really thank you so much for your time. I'm going to let you get back to the work because I know it's busy times in Manchester with both United and City. Thank you, as always, for coming on the program.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me, Glenn.
Thank you, Tyrone.
Great stuff there from Tyrone Marshall, Manchester Evening News, getting into a number of different topics there. By the way, Manchester United, 2-0 winners today over Crystal Palace. You heard him allude to Jadon Sancho as being a target, but a left-footed center-back would be nice. Move Harry Maguire over to the right. De Gea did make a world-class save today, but yeah, there is something going on with him. I don't think there's any question about that. All right, we're going to take a break here. More to come on Soccer Matters. ESPN 97.5, brought to you by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. Also tonight, our new sponsor, Lustau Vermouth. And then, of course, Hugh O'Connor's Pub. All right, we're going to finish it up with some Dynamo talk tonight. Coming up next, Memo Rodriguez, who had two goals against LAFC. I'm going to tell you that he was better off the ball defensively. Memo Rodriguez is up next.
Hi, this is Oliver Luck, and you're listening to Soccer Matters on 97.5 with the irrepressible Glenn Davis.
All right, tonight on Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5, presented by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. We're going to wrap it up in big style. Dynamo midfielder Memo Rodriguez coming off a two-goal performance, outstanding in that opener against LAFC, a 3-3 draw. Dynamo back in action in Orlando. We'll take on the Portland Timbers Saturday night, 7 o'clock Central Time. You can catch it on ESPN. And here's the man himself, Memo Rodriguez, joining it. Memo, thank you so much for coming on the program. And, boy, a great start from a goal-scoring perspective from the Dynamo. 3 goals in the first half against LAFC.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Glenn, for having me. You know, it was a great effort from the guys. Obviously, a little bit frustrated that, you know, we didn't come with the 3 points. But we take all the positives and move forward and look forward to playing the Portland Timbers on Saturday.
All right. So everybody's pointing to these two fantastic goals you scored, and they were great goals. And we'll talk about the goals. But I want to talk about what you did off the ball. I thought your effort defensively, tucking in, pressing people, closing people down, I thought that was tremendous. Lean on the fact that Tab Ramos has said everybody's got to be a two-way player. Talk a little bit about the responsibility on the other side of the ball.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big responsibility because, you know, you can be a great attacker, but if you leave holes behind you, you're not connected with your midfielders or the center back line, you know, it's tough. You get torn down by the other team. You know, they pick you apart in this league. So I think just bringing my energy, you know, Tab said it from the first day, you know, everybody has to be a two-way midfielder. If you play in the midfield position, you got to be able to attack but also defend. And I think with my energy and my work ethic, really helped the team out. And I think me, Mati, and Boni, we're synchronized and we're well tight, keeping the lines tight. And you know, we have to translate that into Portland's game. And I think it's going to be important for us, you know, to stay really, really tight and keep those lines behind us, you know, not open.
Dynamo midfielder Memo Rodriguez joining us. So Tab Ramos in a press conference earlier today said Memo Rodriguez is an interior midfielder. And I think that's what a lot of us have always felt. It must be a music to your ears now to know that your coach is really looking at you as a guy that he wants in the interior of the game, because I know you're most comfortable there and that's where you like to play.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, he's given me all the confidence. You know, when I'm in attacking third, he says, try to find ways to shoot. You know, obviously, if you have a teammate wide open and you want him to score, you know, give him the pass. But, you know, he wants all the midfielders, all the forwards to be aggressive in the attacking third and find ways to create for yourself or for your teammates. And I think that's what makes it so dangerous. You know, you have Albers with his speed. If he got guys one-on-one, you know he's going to take them on. So he wants runners in the box. So we have to trust in Albers that he's going to take his man. I mean, obviously, he's not going to win every battle, but if we trust in 6-7 times that he goes at a guy, you know, 2 or 3 are going to go by and we got to be clinical and be able to finish those balls.
He's Memo Rodriguez. I want to take you to your second goal because Mauro Minotas makes a good run to the near post. He drags Yakovic with him. And then you come flying into that big gap in that central space and get a well-delivered ball. Being in the interior midfield, that's going to allow you to come from deeper. I would think that's an exciting thing to be adding to your repertoire now.
For sure. I mean, like I keep saying, I keep repeating, you know, Tab, you know, he wants those runs. Obviously, you saw me, I was drifting a little bit. And then when Blackman, you know, turned his head a little bit, looked at me, that's when I took off. I saw Mauro's run. I mean, he actually mentioned it to me before that he was going to do that run so I can run in behind. He actually thought Darwin was the guy behind him because he also told Darwin as well that, you know, the center backs get pulled out. You know, they want to double team Albert because of his pace. And, you know, me and Darwin or Boni, you know, have to be able to read that and try to get into the box and you know, score goals. And I think we did a great job in the first half in doing that and getting in the box and creating chances. So, you know, it's going to be important when we play Portland, you know, to get those chances and be able to finish them.
So you just said something really interesting about Albert Elise and how much attention opponents give him. from being on the field with him. Take us a little deeper into that, and you know, how much fear based on his pace and ability that he puts into opponents, and then how you guys can take advantage of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's no secret that Alberts is like one of the most dangerous players in the league. We know that his pace is, you know, it's crazy. Nobody can catch him in open field. So if there's two guys always gonna, from the back line that are always going to try to trap him, you know, there's always going to be one or two guys open. So we have to take advantage of that. And I think Alberts did a very good job in noticing, you know, when to take guys on or when to pass it back and move. So, I mean, we just players off the ball have to be smart and know when they're going to try to double him down and make runs or be able to create space for them to find the open guy. So, I mean, that's going to be key for us in every game in this tournament, to be smart on how teams double down Alberts. If they don't, I mean, if they don't, you know, we're going to give all that confidence to Alberts to take his man on and get in the box, because we know that he's going to get a cross off.
All right, let's go to your first goal. I just love the conviction in that. I mean, you pick the ball up. I'm at home and I'm like, man, keep going. And, you know, of course, you kept going. You made I don't know what Latif Blessing was doing. It looked like he was at a disco. You left him behind, and then you squeezed it in at the near post. Just talk about that goal, because I love the fact that you just drove with conviction. It was just like, you know what, I'm taking a risk here.
Yeah, I mean, it's important for me to be aggressive in the attacking third. You know, sometimes, often when you're on the left wing, you know, sometimes there's faster guys and you have to beat them with a wall pass. But in the midfield, you know, there's players think there's three guys around you, and I think sometimes it's easier to take three guys on, because, you know, you have them in between on what they're going to do. So, I mean, I try to go at Latif, you know, fake the shot, and I knew there was two guys behind him. So I knew that I had a dribble, and that was the only place that I could put the shot at, really, because you see there was two defenders behind him. So, you know, I tried to shoot right there, and, you know, with power, and it went in. And, you know, that's all credit to us being aggressive, not just me. You see all the guys where we had numbers up top. But, you know, we want every player in the attacking third to go at guys. So, I mean, Tab says it every time, you know, be aggressive. Because the players aren't going to get mad if you lose the ball in the attacking third. We need to know when to lose the ball and, you know, trust our defending. So I think if players are aggressive and try to beat their man, nobody's going to get angry for losing the ball and trying to score goals. So, I mean, it's risks we have to take during games. So it's important for everybody to continue to be aggressive.
Dynamo midfielder Memo Rodriguez ahead of the Houston Dynamo taking on the Portland Timbers. It would be their second game down in Orlando. The MLS is back tournament, 7:00. You can catch this game on ESPN. Take me into how things are a little bit different with this manager. All coaches have different personalities. You've played for a bunch of them. Tell me how Tab is different and how it's kind of galvanized this team. This seems to be a very together group of guys based on first impression.
Yeah, I mean, Tab's did a very good job. I think he's trying to bring that culture back or a new culture that everybody is a part of, from the fans to the staff to the academy. And I think you're seeing that. You know, you had Nico Lamore just made his debut. You have the two, Juan and Danny, just signed a homegrown deal. I think he's trying to bring a culture for everybody. And it was from the start, from day one. You know, he always said, We're not here to make playoffs. You know, we haven't made playoffs in 2 years. We're not here to play playoffs, try to make it. We're here to win the whole thing. And we're going to do that as a family. So it's always family against everybody. So I think he's bringing that culture back that everybody wants to see, from the fans, like I said, from the fans, just everybody in the Dynamo organization together. And I think he's doing a great job of that. And I think you're seeing the results. Obviously, everybody – when their players super excited to get back on the field and perform.
Things happen with different coaches. It seems to be me now that everybody feels like there's possibility. I mean, with Nico Lemoine coming on, I mean, that to me symbolizes right down to the academy. It seems like everybody now feels like they got a shot to be on the field.
Yeah, I mean, everybody, I think training is so intense, because you have that internal competition of guys want to be in the starting lineup. And I mean, like you said, Nico Lemoy, I think you can put anybody on the field, any player on the sub list, on the reserve list, into the starting 11, just because everybody's working so hard and everybody's going to fill in for the guy next to him, and everybody's willing to fight and use all their energy we have five subs. So everybody knew, you know, if you were going to cramp in the minute 60, go 60 minutes hard and help the team in any way possible that you can. And the next guy next to you is going to come in and is going to do the same job that you did. So, I mean, it's great to see everybody, you know, fighting for a spot, and that's going to make our team even better.
All right, last year, I think everybody around the league termed you guys a counterattacking team. You might have had to do that a little bit against LAFC. We understand LAFC is still one of the standard bearers in the league, certainly when it comes to ball possession and attacking. What type of team do you think you'll evolve into this year? Because it seems like you're going to be capable of doing a number of different things from a tactical standpoint. And, of course, you have a coach who is a great possession player himself, so I would imagine that's what he wants to see out of his team as well.
Yeah, I think we're evolved as a team that we can do both. Obviously, against LAFC, we knew that they're a team that pressures high, that wants to keep the ball as much as they can. So, you know, we had to be more direct. That was just the game plan of like you said, like you mentioned. So I think we can do both. We have the qualities of keeping the ball. I mean, there were spells in the game where, you know, we broke them down with a penetrating ball or giving a 1-2 with the player. So I think we're a two-way team. You know, depending on the opponent, we're going to be able to keep the ball or be direct. But most of the time, you know, we always want to look forward and try to keep the ball in the attacking third rather than on our defensive side. So I think under Tab, you know, he always, you know, possession is going to be possession. But if you keep possession 90% of the time and you don't score and the other team scores, then that possession has no value too. So we want to be direct sometimes and try to score goals. But when we have to slow the game down, you know, we are capable of doing it.
Do you expect to get more possession against Portland based on the way they play? Because sometimes they like to kind of sit back and invite you in.
Yeah, I think we're going to have the same amount of possession, if not more. I think we're going to try to attack them as much as we can. But like I mentioned, we want to slow the play down. Obviously, in this heat and this humidity, you got to slow the pace down a little bit, even though we're accustomed to it. But, you know, we're all human. We get tired in minute 70 on. So we just have to learn how to manage the game because they're going to be even more tired. They're from the West Coast and Portland. It doesn't get hot and humid. So, you know, we had to have that as an advantage and, you know, keep the ball and just have them make them run.
Well, Memo, thank you very much for coming on the program tonight. All the fans appreciate it. I certainly appreciate it. Best of luck against the Portland Timbers.
Thank you, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
All right. The one and only Memo Rodriguez, two goals against LAFC. Look for him again against the Portland Timbers Saturday night. That does it here tonight on Soccer Matters ESPN 97.5, brought to you by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. For Aaron Raybould, Victor Ariza, I'm Glenn Davis. Until next week.
ESPN 97.5.